Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
May 7th, 2017, episode 110. I work out. This is the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast, where we sit and chat with ourselves sometimes. No, actually, we're talking to you about beekeeping. My name is Kevin England, and I really sit back every once in a while and think about the podcast and enjoy the fact that I get to have a dialogue and get a lot of communication from folks. And this is one of those episodes where a bunch of different topics come up. A lot of them have their genesis in just certain conversations with people that I've talked to recently, or communications through email or feedback or Facebook posts and so on. And, you know, that's kind of a neat thing. I wanted to say what's going through my mind this morning is that it's a weird spring here in New Jersey. I don't know why I don't feel the zen, the karma, the warmth, the loving sunshine of it. I see all the trees are in bloom. I saw the forsythia come up. Their dandelions have changed to little floaty seeds. But it still feels cold and not very spring-like. I don't know. Not feeling the vibe. I'm hoping the bees are doing great, but like, you know, as I record this, it's 50-something degrees outside, which is a little weird. I'm looking for a little warmer spring, but I don't want it to be one of those super hot summers. I don't know, do you have that sense every once in a while? The season just doesn't feel right? Anyway. Yeah, a lot of things to talk about in the episode. Wax moth control. Got some feedback from Rex Smith about glyphosate and the conversation we had in the last episode. I want to tell you about the bee gym. Have a term, phototaxis. A lid-locking contraption, a couple different options there. I made the honey bars. And some feedback on the EPA and oxalic acid. Been talking about that recently, and I'm not sure if I have the full picture. Maybe I'm out of the loop. That happens occasionally. So, yeah, lots to talk about on this episode. To that end, the local hive report is rather interesting, and, you know, no better time than the present. Let's go ahead and get started. Local hive report. Yeah, things are okay. Kind of quiet this week. We just told you what was going on recently. You know, come to think of it, in episode 109, I recorded the conversation of me out in the bee yard, and then released the episode a couple days later, and it may have confused matters. So I think if I'm going to record at a different time where I'm not literally sitting down and producing the episode, I will tell you what the time frame is so you can have some context to that. To that end, you probably hear me walking through and crunching leaves. I'm out walking the dog on Sunday morning. I'm looking out across the field. I see beautiful horses under a cool, breezy day. It's about 50-something degrees out here this morning. Chance of rain. And that's a good start off, because that's exactly what happened yesterday. Yesterday, in our area, it was cool. It rained on and off. We had showers throughout the day. It was not a very good day to open up bees. Had activities in the morning. Brian did his SAT, so I was shuffling him around because Sharon's out of town. So I didn't get into the bees till the afternoon. There was a short period of warmth and a little bit of sunshine break in the afternoon, and I took the opportunity to scoot out and see what was going on. And as soon as the sun broke for that small period of time, the bees were flying for a little bit. So I got to see some activity. If I recount what I saw, starting at the first location, the original one on my property, pad number one, is the nuke that we made up last week. It wasn't flying, it wasn't doing much, but that's not to be expected. They're probably getting organized and getting things set up in there. Pad number two is the gateway hive. And the gateway hive was hammering. It was just going to town. It looked great. A lot of flying, a lot of resource gathering, bright neon pollen going in and out. Didn't really do anything other than just observe what was going on at the entrance. Same thing could be said for the second hive there, the 8-frame hive. It was flying. I was very happy to see that, bringing in a lot of resources. The next pad is the two nukes that started last week. The first nuke wasn't doing much, like the nuke on pad number one. The second nuke was doing nothing. And the second nuke's the one that I wondered whether or not they had a queen. So I did break that open, no smoke, and looked at it. And I wanted to share a new thing that I've been doing. I just recently revised my... I did my annual review of my hive inspection forms, and I changed something that I wanted to do, which was make it all checkbox oriented so I could breeze right through it. I was listening to the Beehive Jive where they were talking about the bother of doing hive inspection sheets, and I always felt the same way. So what I've done is I've made everything a checkbox. Check, 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 check. And then when I record, and I record these on my phone, I go through and I have a certain way that I articulate what's going on with the bees. So the reason I'm telling you this is one of the things I do is what's the quantity of bees in the box? And I want it to be a little more analytical so I can get a sense. And the way the form works out is that if you scan the form, you could tell, are there a lot of bees in the box? Are they all to the right-hand side or are they all to the left? So to understand the scale, the scale is 0, 1, 2, and 3. 0 means when I look at the face of the comb, do I see any bees? If I don't, it's a 0. If 1/3 is covered with bees, I'll give it a 1. If 2/3 is covered with bees, I will give it a 2. If 3/3, or the entire fourth face, is covered, I will give it a 3. And what I typically do when I articulate to my phone, which is in my pocket in my bee suit, is side 1, 1. Side 2, 2. When bees. And then I rate the pollen and the nectar in the same manner. Nectar is a 1. Nectar is a 0. Nectar is a 2. Pollen is a 1. And I do it in this order. I do bees first. Nectar second. Pollen third. Capped honey fourth. All the while I'm noting what the bee makeup is, if I see a lot of drones and so on. In the last couple inspections that I've done, I've been able to go back analytically and look at how strong the bees are. And I think this is going to help me quite a bit in understanding, was this thing really as strong as I thought it was or not? And it's fairly easy to track. So yeah, that's pretty cool. Using that system, let me take you through the hive. Frame 1, both sides, 0. Frame 2, both sides, 0. Frame 3, 0. Side 1, 1. Side 2. Frame 4, 1. Side 1, 1. Side 2. Frame 5, maybe a half, not even a 1. And on the far side, nothing. So what does that tell you? No bees in this box. Not a lot going on. There were some resources and so on, but not enough. And so with the poverty of bees, it's not difficult to determine whether there's a queen or not. And I'm able to look through every single frame, and that's what I did, and no sign of a queen. So this hive doesn't have a queen. Now I found a cell on the face, a supersedure cell, and it was open. Maybe this queen was out getting mated, but the supersedure cell looked terrible. It just wasn't very good. It looked like something they tried to do and it wasn't going to work. So, you know, this hive is done. It's not going to work. It was a split gone bad. Let's just call it that. Or so what to do? I could leave these bees in there hopeless, and they were scattered all over the frame. It didn't make a lot of sense. So what I did was I took a board and I laid it against the 8-frame and I shook half of the bees on that. And then I took a board and I shook it in front of the nuke, and I moved the nuke that was next to it in the same position. And when the bees all flew back, they flew and went inside the other nuke. So all the bees got repurposed to other hives. And then I just put this nuke away, hoping that somewhere along the line I'm going to encounter a swarm. So tried to start 3 hives there. 2 of them took, 1 did not. That's how it goes sometimes. During the day, I walked, right after I finished all that activity, I walked over to the second location. The nuke there was the same as the other nukes, not a lot going on. A couple bees, drips and drabs, leaving. I'm assuming that queen is hatched by now, given how big it was and capped. And then the other 2 hives, the one that started as a package and the polystyrene hive, like the gateway hive, was just flying like crazy. Tons of bees going in and out. Bright neon yellow pollen going in. Bees looking heavy landing on the pad. They look good. Even though it was a cool, somewhat crappy day with rain. And by the way, both times I was out there on both yards doing what I was doing, it started sprinkling on and off while I was there. So not really ideal, but these bees were out foraging and doing their thing. So, that's an okay hive report. It means things are going. I really would like to go take a look at the package hive. It's the only one I haven't really opened this year. It's got plenty of boxes on it and space. The bees seem to be doing okay. It's moderately heavy. But I haven't found that warm day that I can actually crack the thing open and see what its resources are. So I'm just going to let them be. Let them ride. Let them do their thing. So from a local hive report, things are good. It's kind of funny. I really wish that I had a little more going on. I don't know. I feel like things are a little static right now, but maybe this is the way it's supposed to be. It's stable and it's no drama and so on. Haven't seen any indication that hives are swarming yet in my yard, so that's good. I'm pretty sure I thwarted a swarm by making the split of the one hive, so that's it. That's about all there is to say about the local hive report. Pretty non-dramatic, which is the way we like it. So at the end of the walk, I walked up into the field to see if the bees were flying this morning, even though it's cool, clammy, whatever. And yeah, look at that. They're flying away. Oh, there goes a little bunny rabbit running through. I don't see them very often because the hawks typically get them. Bright cotton white tail as it runs off. But I'm looking. Damn if I didn't get just stung. That sucks. Wow. Just got stung on the face. Son of a. I'll keep it PG. Scrape the stinger out of my face. Boy, I tell you, I don't know what I'd do to deserve that. Banana. I really smelled a huge smell of banana there. That's the first time ever. Wow, that's fascinating. You know, they say that bee sting pheromone, when you get stung, smells like banana. And I just got stung on the face, right underneath my nose, and I got a huge smell of banana. How's that for real time? All right, so now I'm standing behind the hives. God. couldn't make a mistake. Oh, the dog just got... Did she just got stung? She just got stung. Wow, what's with these girls? How about that? Well, that's real and live and in person. So these bees are flying, as you could tell. Yeah. All right. Wow, I would not have anticipated that. Well, you get to live a little bit vicariously through me, right? I'm standing here looking at the hives, talking to you about how they're flying, even though it's cool. It's only like 55 degrees and overcast, like I said. And I got stung on the face, just to the right side of my nose. And then the dog got stung and ran off, and she's out in the woods somewhere. And Tiger the Bee Cat came, and he's standing with me, but I don't know if he's going to get stung. So I'm walking out of the field, and I'm going to go back in the house and lick my wounds. Yeah, so they're flying. Yeah, okay. Let's go ahead and end the local hive report and go to segment number one. Wow. Here comes the dog running like crazy. Did you hear that? She ran past me like a... She's run the entire length of the driveway. I don't know if the bee's still chasing her or not. Wow. All right, let's go ahead to segment one. Segment number one is called Planet Zentauri. Zentauri. Whoa, la, la, la. I can't help but think of the song Valari. Actually, the joke of the title has no bearing on the song that I just sung, but the name of the product I'm about to tell you about reminds me of the name, perhaps, of a planet that would be in Star Wars or something. Commander for 1 Alpha 7, we're just about to send the boarding party down to surface of Zentauri to meet up with the Rebel Force. And actually, Zentauri is the name of a product marketed for the control of wax moths. Bob Kloss told me of this quote-unquote new product someone made him aware of for the control of wax moth and provided me with some to use. It's a yellow-colored granule product that has the consistency of powdered yeast packet. He passed it along in a Ziploc bag with the word Zentauri, spelled X-E-N-T-A-R-I, scrawled on it in black Sharpie. Under it, there's a notation to use 1/4 teaspoon per gallon. It is the magic formula for wax moths. What could go wrong? He said he looked it up and found all kinds of information about this stuff on BeeSource, and it's been used for a long time by beekeepers. At this time of year, 2 targets come into focus. Galleria melanella, that's the name for the greater wax moth, and Acroia grisella, which is the lesser wax moth. As a beekeeper, you'll find that you come across these moths in 2 ways. You'll lose track of a hive that did not survive, and when you go to retrieve it, you find that it has been overtaken. Or you have equipment in storage, and upon going back to it, you find that it's been infested. Given my busy schedule, I've encountered both of these situations. And I abhor to having to scrape out wax moth infestations, and I'm ashamed to admit that I've had to do it on more than one occasion. Every year at springtime, I think about this and say, wow, I'm hoping I'm not storing comb that is being infested out in the garage. Wax moth infested hives are difficult to clean up sometimes. And if you have an infestation, it can ruin frames and hive equipment. In the past, I've used moth flakes from a bee supply house on my stacks, and I've even taken into cutting out all the comb from old comb so that it won't have anything to tempt the little buggers. Funny, compared to some, I'm no seasoned veteran, but I've been around a while, and I would have thought somewhere, somehow, my travels, I might have crossed paths with this method of using Zentauri for controlling wax moths. As I've discovered into looking into it, it's apparently well known, but I have not heard of it. Nope, never, not once. So of course, curiosity kicks in and off to the interwebs. At the base of this product, I have learned, is Bacillus thuringiensis. That second word is said a bit differently than how it's spelled. Thuringiensis, thuringiensis. It's typically abbreviated as BT. I know how to pronounce it, as I saw a video produced and found from the National Pesticide Information Center at Oregon State University. So what is BT? According to that video, thuringiensis are related soil microbes. There are different types of these BT-related microbes, and they make
different forms of proteins that are toxic to certain insects. Insects that eat the different forms of these BT microbes and the proteins contained within experience these proteins changing shape inside the insect's digestive tract, which in turn allows that protein to attach itself to the lining of the stomach. This causes a hole in the insect's stomach lining and results in the insect not eating any further, and eventually it perishes from this condition. I found a paper that describes this in scientific terms, and I wanted to share an insight of how it literally works inside the target insect. From the paper, quote, "The mode of action of the three-domain cryotoxin family involves sequential interaction of these toxins with several insect midgut proteins, facilitating the formation of a pre-pore oligomer structure and subsequent membrane insertion that leads to the killing of midgut insect cells by osmotic shock," end quote. That's from the paper, "Mode of Action, Bacillus thuringiensis cry and site toxins and their potential for insect control," which I'll have a link to in the show notes. So going back to the video that was produced by the National Pesticide Information Center at Oregon State University, they show a little picture of a toxin floating into the digestive tract, and it turns into a triangle and it plugs into a hole, and then they indicate water leaks out, which must be the osmosis part of what I just described as the mechanism of action. So as it turns out, these microbes are not harmful to humans or animals, even if we touch them, consume them through eating, or breathe them in. It appears that we as humans do not undergo that protein change, so when we eat or ingest this, it just passes through our system. To reinforce that notion, the video that I've mentioned a couple times already indicates that they fed this to rats for about 2 years, and they had human volunteers who ingested it, and then they did the test to prove what I just told you. In further testing, it appears it has not been found to be harmful to other mammals, shrimp, birds, and rodents. It does, however, have an impact on water fleas, which are an important problem, and therefore one should take care not to discard this or allow it to get into water systems, as it appears water fleas are a valuable source of food in the food chain, and lest we impact the food chain. So BT is found in a number of insect products targeted for certain types of insects. Mostly you'll see it in products for caterpillars, immature flies, and mosquitoes. I found a list that indicates it can be used for anyworms, diamondback moths, hornworms, green clover worm, imported cabbage worm, loopers, melon worm, pickle worm, mimosa webworm, salt marsh caterpillar, tomato fruit worm, corn earworm, bollworm, tobacco bollworm, budworm, end quote, and on and on and on. One of the more common aspects you might have picked up through that little run through there is the word worm. It might be noted that one of the things that's not listed there is the wax moth. Actually, we're not after the moth itself, but we're after it when the moth is in the worm state. So we're thinking about using this around beehives. What about bees? Do they have a problem with this? Because, you know, they have a worm state, of course. I said in the outset that there are different variants of Bacillus thuringiensis. One strain in particular, BT azawai, spelled A-I-Z-A-W-A-I, has been reported to cause problems for honeybees. When you consider this, you have to consider two things. Will it impact adults? And will it impact brood, which, after all, has a worm stage? And I'm talking about BT. On that point, this particular strain of BT, there are different ideas. There's a study from the FDA that says to avoid BT Azawai, and I've seen statements saying this particular form of BT is highly toxic to bees, including aforementioned video from before. In a Bee Source Forum discussion, it was said that the FDA pretty much bombed a honeybee colony with this stuff and did not use it in the manner in which commercial products recommend, and therefore it nuked the colony and it is claimed by the FDA to be harmful. That was an anecdotal response from a forum member who looked into this, apparently. And it was the most that I could find. But it gives suspicion for whether this stuff is a problem or not. I found an article from Cornell on this topic, and it states, quote, "Applications of labeled rates of formulated BT have not been toxic to beneficial or predator insects. Treatment of honeycombs with BT var azawai will not have a detrimental effect upon bees nor the honey produced," end quote. So which is it? My practical side would say that it's not a problem if used in the manner intended by the manufacturer. The consideration here is that, one, you are likely to be spraying it proactively on comb that you have in storage, and therefore no harm will come to bees. And second, if you're spraying it on an active colony for some reason, don't spray it on the brood itself, which in turn would mean, to me, don't spray it on components of an operational colony. Take out what is affected and keep the rest small so the bees can defend it. But that's just me. You know, for those who are not inclined to understand what I just said, this is what the common wisdom is for treating wax moths. If you have a problem with a colony in the wild, it's that the bees can't defend the comb. Shrink the colony down to a size that the bees can defend, and everything that you take off you could spray with this BT. That's kind of what I meant by that passage. So how does one use this biological insecticide? The intent is 1/4 teaspoon of the powder to 1 gallon of water. Mix it up extremely well, and then spray it on the comb that has worms in it, or the combs that you want to protect. The goal is to try to get a fine mist down into the bottom of the cells. And apparently if you're seeing water run off the comb, you're wasting it, as you simply just have to mist it in. The important part is to get it into the cells itself. Spray them, let them air dry, and voila, you're good to go. It's recommended that you mix the formula in small batches and use it right away, as the product goes bad in 2 or 3 days. From what I've read, the product should be used from 2 years from purchase, and what you don't use, you should discard. I've seen videos of people who are taking the dry form of this product and sprinkling it on plants by hand that have caterpillar problems to protect them. So if you have something munching on something in your garden that is in the worm form, it's likely this product will work. I'm not suggesting you go experiment in that way. I'm just saying that's what I understand about it. As an alternate view of this, you might consider a different product which is sold for worm control called Safer Brand 5162 Garden Dust Caterpillar Killer. It's sold on Amazon and it has BT. And it's a different strain of BT called BT Kurstaki, spelled Kurstaki. It's sold for the purpose of dusting plants in the manner that I just described, but it uses a different form of BT, not the azawi form that the FDA indicated that is bad for honeybees. And from what I've read, it is also effective. So, you know, concerning the approach, though, I will say that Centauri brand product was apparently formulated with honeybee comb production in mind, or at least beekeepers used it, and it's still labeled for use in a beekeeping form in Canada and appears to have been approved in the U.S. at some point, but it didn't get renewed for use for beekeeping. From what I've read, and this is from Michael Bush's website, You know, Michael Bush, just an amazing dude. He has something on everything. He and Rusty from Honey Bee Sweet, they've covered all these topics. It's amazing how much they've covered in their travels. And I'm guessing sometimes they look at our stuff and say, oh, they didn't know that either. But just great that people give back in that way. So anyway, Michael Bush, he's the one that had a passage that said there was no funding to renew it in the U.S. so it's not on our shelves and in our beekeeping supply homes for wax moth control. So application of the product can be done in a dry form, or as I said, and specifically for beekeeping, mixed with water in the right concentration and sprayed onto your frames. It's important to note a couple things about the product. Sunlight breaks down the microbes quickly. So you want to use it in an area where things are not exposed to direct sunlight, or you're wrecking your ability to have it be effective. And it does not survive in high heat. My guess is these microbes get killed when they're stored in high heat situations. In the end, I'll say, well, it was an interesting topic to dig in on. I'm a little bit nervous about talking about it because there's no specific direction from some noted expert that says do this, do that, and you'll end up with this outcome for beekeeping. And I have to wonder if I asked Tim Schuler, the state apiarist, if this is labeled or what he knows about it, whether he would wrinkle a nose at it. Would I tell you or would I recommend it safe? To me, this is one of those do as you do, not as I say moments. I simply found it interesting that this was out there. It's a practice apparently still used to this day in beekeeping, and for some reason I had not heard of it, so I dug in. I run the risk sometimes on this podcast of swaying people to run out and experiment with things like this, and that's not my intention. Of course, several of you will. It's just your nature, I suppose. There are a number of things that I read that I didn't have time to include in any manner, or I skimmed over periphery ideas about what I've included here. For example, I spent some time reading about a study where they put BT powder in a collector on a landing board of an active hive with the intention of the bees passing through this powder as they were leaving the hive. And they were targeting the bees to take this powder out to the sunflowers that they were visiting to kill the worms that were eating the sunflowers. The conclusion of this symbiotic study is it worked, and the bees made a good transport mechanism, and it did no harm to the bees as they recovered from the study. But I think there was a footnote, and again, I didn't dig into this study, that said this might not be the greatest idea without further study, because if the bees bring it back in and it gets deposited in the brood, it could potentially impact the worms inside the hive. So, yeah. That's what I'm talking about, folks. Use caution when we talk about stuff like this. There's probably other resources out there that give better guidance on whether you should or should not. As for me, I'm going to take this approach. Wait. I'm going to do this. It doesn't mean you should. Just trying to make sure this clear point is. I'm going to try it. I'm going to spray it on the stuff that's in my garage. And the stuff that I brought in recently that didn't make it through, I will never spray this on an active hive. And I will make sure that when I spray it on something, whatever it is, I'm going to put it out in the sunlight before I put it into an actual hive down the road. And I've been really good about keeping good notes. So I'll make sure that I keep notes and don't lose track of this type of thing. But it sure seems more convenient than some of the other methods of taking care of it, and I want to know whether it works or not. So that's an interesting aspect of why I'm doing what I'm doing. So listen, if you are interested in more information, check out our show notes. I'll have a link to the video. I'll have a link to the mode of action. I'll have a link if you're interested in reading about the different forms of BT to the Safer Garden Dust on Amazon. And I did find a source for Centauri at a place called Hid Hut, H-I-D-H-U-T that sells it online. Because inevitably somebody's going to ask me where you find this stuff. And there you can go read about it, see the MSDS sheet, and look at the package and learn more about it if that's your interest. Segment number two. Glyphosate redux. In the last episode, we talked about glyphosate, and I talked about the study where they were looking at feeding bees out in the field and whether it had an impact on their navigation. The finding in that study was that they were not finding any problems with that based on their research. That being said, and I opened that statement saying that glyphosate and the study of it in contrast to bees is probably a body of work and not a single article. And to that end, no sooner did the episode come out, I think it was that day, that I got a response back from Rex Smith, one of our frequent listeners, that there was indeed an article published in 2015 that indicates the effects of sublethal doses of glyphosate on honeybee navigation is not a good story. And it's funny, Rex, thanks for sending that in. When I look at this, I've seen this article. I've seen the maps that show the way the bees fly around. And I think I've even seen a video somewhere of the radar system that they used in order to talk about how the bees navigate and how they could tell whether they were impacted or not from the exposure to glyphosate, or aka Monsanto Roundup. So they subjected the bees to three sublethal concentrations, 2.5, 5, and 10 milligram per insect, and they wanted to check the homeward flight path of honeybees in an open field. They performed the experiment by taking the forager honeybees and training them to an artificial feeder so that they can get them used to going back and forth to a resource. Then they captured these bees and fed them with the solutions containing traces of GLY, glyphosate, and released them to see whether or not their flight paths would change. So they also said that bees performed more indirect homing flights. Moreover, the proportion of direct homeward flights performed after a second release from the same site increased in control bees, but not in treated bees. I'm taking that to mean that the control bees found their way home, but the treated bees struggled with it. To quote what they said, quote, "These results suggest that, in honeybees, exposure to levels of GLY commonly found in agricultural settings impairs the cognitive capacities needed to retrieve and integrate spatial information for successful return to the hive. Therefore, honeybee navigation is affected by ingesting trace amounts of the most widely used herbicide worldwide, with potential long-term negative consequences for colony foraging success." End quote. So looking through the article itself, I'm looking at one of the figures, figure three. It shows the time of response. With 22 bees tested as a control, average time in minutes was somewhere in the 5 minute time frame. 2.5 milligram, 10 bees tested 5 minutes. 5 milligrams of GLY, 10 bees tested. Yeah, 5 minutes, but the spread of when they returned, short and small, was a little bit wider. 10 milligrams fed of GLY with 8 bees. The time was 9 minutes. So that's interesting. In the context of what they're talking about, one impact is how much time does it take for them to find their way back. It's pretty clear looking at these that 0, 2.5, 5 milligram are all relatively even, but 10 is completely different, and it's easy to see from the graph. So the other graph of note is the one that is the direct and indirect homeward flight after the second release. If you look at the control group, 12 of the 16 bees had direct flights. 6 of the seven bees, 2.5 milligram, had direct flight. Eight of the 10 bees, 5 milligram, had direct flight. So when you look at the flights there, direct flight from the feeder back to the hive is predominant. It's pretty easy to see. In the context of 10 milligram, one direct flight, three indirect. Now, these are small sample sizes. I mean, four bees. But still, that's interesting when you look at it because it's the polar opposite of the other one. And you have to wonder, if you watch this every day, would this potentially show some sort of habit on the bees that are getting exposed to GLY? So this study, released from the Journal of Experimental Biology 2015, looks like it is journal article 218, pages 2799 to 2805, was published in, you know, I have to say as an aside, harmonic radar tracking. How cool would it be? I know I've said this before on the podcast. I would love to put something on the bees and see where they go from your hive. I wish they could figure that out for the everyday common person, that you could see where your bees are foraging. Maybe we don't want to know, but it would be really, really neat to see where the bees in your yard are going. One other aside about this research. I see all the names. They look foreign. Maria Sol Paul Buena, Leah Tisson, Marie-Louise Hahn, Hugh Gregers, Randolph Menzel. These are the authors of it. And this is interesting footnote. Walter M. Farina. And Walter Farina was on that other article about glyphosate that I was covering in episode 109. So you have to wonder if this is an area of study for Walter. Or perhaps somebody who's an expert in this field that they consult with, because Walter turned up on both of these papers. So we say this about 15 times an episode, but yeah, I'll have a link to this in the show notes. You can take a look at it. And Rex, thanks for sending that along. Added to the pile of things about glyphosate and see what happens in the end. Wow. Good one. Thanks. So two segments for this episode. Let's go ahead and head to the back of the book, have a pile of round tables. Let's go on to round table number one. Round table number one. Call this one, a workout. I got a message on Facebook from Martha Rivera. Wanted to know if I had ever heard of, because I haven't talked about it on the podcast, a bee gym. And if I thought it was an effective part of varroa mite control, and would it make a difference? So, yeah, the bee gym. The reason you haven't heard me talk about it is I'd never heard of it. So I looked it up and followed the videos for it and started to look at what this thing is and what the background of it is. If you go to the Beekeeping Learning Center from Dedant and Sons, you'll find a video that's a little weird. It's hard to figure out what it is. It shows this plastic contraption with these things sticking out, and you see the bees rubbing back and forth on it. I got this message on Facebook from Facebook Messenger while I was on my phone sitting in a meeting, and I was so fascinated by it that I was sitting there with my phone underneath the table at the conference room watching the bees scrape their abdomens back and forth on this. Enthralled I was. So the videos that I found online come from YouTube, someone named Stuart Roweth, R-O-W-E-T-H. The one video has about 27,000 views, but the other ones have 300 and 400. I found two other videos. One of them has a bee gym in a tree. It looks like a swarm trap style device next to a tree. And the other one is a close-up shot. So let me tell you what I see in this. You see bees taking their underside and scraping them against what they call in this device, a flipper. So it looks like a little piece of plastic, and on the plastic there is it looks like wire almost sticking up, a little blade. And what you see is the bees sit on top of that blade and they rub their abdomen back and forth across it. And the speculation in the video is that as they do this, they're either scraping the mic off or damaging it. The video indicates that all of the bees you see operating on this flipper were there, and the device has only been there for 3 days. So the bees apparently know this technique of grooming and immediately are able to take advantage of the device when it's put in. So there's not a ton of information about this. Best I could see is it looks like the device is some sort of square contraption, and it sits on the floor of the hive. And I could completely get this wrong because I really can't understand what the device itself is. I'll do my best to describe it. It comes, by the way, out of Europe, and it's a patented device. It's a plastic device. On one end, it has two protrusions that go up, and there's a wire that runs across from one to the other. And then on the plastic tubes, there's four of them that make up the square, there's little flippers that stick up. And a little post with a little nub that sticks up. That's the best I could tell from what I see of the picture. And what happens is the bees, when they land on this thing, any one of those bee gym protrusions they can use to scrape the varroa mite off the bottom of the bee. They could scrape it on the wire. They could scrape it on these little plastic fins or flippers. They could scrape it on that little nub. And the expectation is that if you left this in the hive, eventually the bees would do it. They would figure it out. And according to the video that I saw, it was 3 days old and the bees were scraping on it when the footage was captured. Now, take this thing and put it over top of a screen bottom board and put a sticky board underneath, and you could probably use that in combination to figure out whether it's effective or not. So the instructions say to leave this about 2 centimeters, CMS, I think that's the abbreviation, back from the hive entrance, or on top of the brood frame in a shallow eek or spacer. So you could put it on top of the frames and put a little something like an emery shim, for example. They do indicate that you move it back from the front entrance so that foragers coming in with pollen don't scrape it off and don't have to encounter the device. There's also a recommendation with it that says move it around a little bit so it keeps the interest up of the bees, and you could use it all year long. So actually, I think it's pretty ingenious and interesting device. If you go to the website, vita-europe.com, and look in their product section, you'll see more detail on the bee gym from the people who produced it. There is a picture of the device sitting flat on a mesh bottom board, I'm assuming. It's got a bunch of holes in it, and they show a bunch of different bees in positions where they can be grooming themselves. The advantages of this, per the website, is chemical-free, economical, no extra apiary visits. You could leave it in there all year long. Foragers returning with pollen baskets choose to avoid it, so there's no risk of pollen being lost. And a couple other things. I'm not going to drain the website. You can go look at it for yourself if you're interested. It appears at this point that the only U.S. beekeeping supply house that's providing this is Dedant. So we'll provide you a link in the show notes to that. Also, there's a couple videos from Stuart Roweth. I'm literally watching one where the bees are coming in and going, and they're encountering the device, and they're going up over the screen, and they're working on it. It looks like he pulled a couple frames out. Remember the episode where I talked about the way you set the frames in a hive? You could set them one way where the end of the frame faces the entrance, or the other way where the face, in this case, he must be running national hives because it looks like the face is parallel to the front entrance. And so he's taken a couple frames out, and you could see the bees coming in and going up over this thing on the bottom board in the particular video I was just watching. So there's a couple videos. They only have a couple hundred views. So this thing is relatively obscure here on YouTube, and my guess is most people, including myself, don't know about that. So anyway, thanks, Martha. I really appreciate you taking the time to send over the question, and sorry I didn't get back to you sooner or directly. As I said, I encountered it at work, and then I forgot about it. And this morning, while I was going through a bunch of things, it rang in my brain. So I went through and pulled it back out. So hopefully you'll hear the response here, and I'll go see if I can reply to you back by the means you contacted me. While I'm at it, visiting that website, Vita, V-I-T-A, or Vita, I don't know how they say it, on their homepage, they have Apishield, which is a hornet trap. I guess, you know, a lot of people are worried about the Asian hornet, and there's a contraption there where you can trap the Asian hornets using this wooden box. I really hope we don't have to deal with that, but for any of those who are looking for one of these, this too is for sale apparently on Daedon, according to their website, but I know people are talking about this. You can go to that website, Vita, V-I-T-A, Europe.com, and look that up. Okay, let's move along. Again, thanks. Appreciate it, Martha, for the tip on that. So for roundtable number two, I'm going to bring you a term and a story. We all know that bees and insects tend to go to light. The term for this episode is phototaxis, which is defined as bodily movement of a motile organism in response to light. Motile refers to being capable of moving. In the case of insects, we often know that they are attracted by light. And what's interesting about the definition of phototaxis is it has two attributes. There's a positive phototaxis, or movement to light, and there's a negative phototaxis, which is behavior to move away from it. So honeybees, as it turns out, upon emerging, are negatively phototactic, which means they will prefer to stay in the dark and avoid leaving the hive for a period of time. In early days, a worker will initially perform the duties of a house bee and learn to find their way about the hive, beg for food, and do the jobs that are required of them, like cleaning cells in the brood area or whatever it is their mission is in life. And I was aware that bees exhibit a positive phototaxis, but came to learn that they are also negative for a while, and thought the concept would make a good term of the episode. So they have a positive one. The story is, last week we had Earth Day and Bring Your Child to Work. They talked me into doing bees and talking about mobile and web. So I did a joint session, and Bob Kloss was just phenomenal in providing me an observation hive. And I was in a conference room with the observation hive sitting on a side table. I had put a live shot of my bees up on the big screen and talked to them about web and mobile and also about bees, but they weren't able to see the bees upright because they were sitting around the conference table and they had no close area to it. So we knew that they were going to take them upstairs in our building, and they were going to let them be in this one open area. So I brought the observation hive and set it on a table there. Well, the observation hive had a battery in the hole where the feeder goes. And I thought, well, I'll just be really quick. I won't let any bees out. I'll slip the feeder in. If one or two get out, I'll pinch them off. No big deal. Well, I pulled the battery out. I put the feeder in. Only one or two bees got out, but I didn't slide the feeder in all the way, and a bunch of bees got out, like 20 of them. And they were flying around, and they went up into the lights, flying around in the lights above the hive. Well, they brought all the children there, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, this is not good. If somebody gets stung, if somebody's allergic, whatever. So I moved the hive to another part of the location, and nobody got stung, no harm happened or whatever. And all the bees that were up there, well, they didn't make it, unfortunately. So I'll go clean them up. But if you wanted to know something of how bees behave, I thought that they would fly from the lights, meaning the overhead lights, to the windows. Because typically if you have a bee loose in the house, have you ever been out in the bee yard and come in and had one on your jacket, and it'll fly to the window and it'll be buzzing against the window, and typically we just open our kitchen windows and let them back out. In this case, I thought they would fly from the fluorescent lights to the windows over next to where our co-op sit. So I went over to our Drexel co-ops that I have working for my team in and ask them. If you see any bees, let me know. And, of course, we can't open the windows there, so I would have had to take care of them. But, nope, none of them left. They all stayed there until a couple days later I went back to check on them and clean them up. So that was not one of my brighter moments, and it becomes a beekeeping story to go. I did it, and I had one of my coworkers standing there, and when a couple of the bees got out, one of them was landing on my hand, and he backed away and walked off. He wasn't too thrilled about that, but I promised him he wouldn't get stung, and nobody got stung, and yeah, it's okay. Not one of my brighter moves, but yeah, life is full of adventures, folks. Roundtable number 3, call this one Lock It Up. You know, there's this piece of equipment that I've seen on Dedant that I had notes on called a cam lock. It's some sort of contraption that it attaches to the side of your hive, and then it has this little lever that you flip over, and it holds the roof down, and it prevents you from having to put a brick on top or put something to weight it. The way that it works is it screws into your top cover and then it locks into place in the handhold of your hive body or your super. So that's an interesting idea, but I'll go one better. I saw this video on YouTube. Cody, K-O-D-Y, Collier is the author of it, called The Locking Beehive Lid. And this thing is truly ingenious in the way that he makes this. It looks like he has a 4-pallet configuration. I watched the video a couple times trying to figure out what he's doing, and he has this locking edge that he sets the hive cover down in a vertical, and then he lays it down, and one lip hooks underneath the other, and it prevents the top from coming off. The other ingenious part of this guy's hive top cover is that it juts out over the edge of the hive, and it has a little return that goes down, so it makes like an L shape. And on the bottom of his pallet, he has the same thing, and he could take a foam component and slide it in that edge, and it's perfectly locked in there, and it creates a foam insulation holder. So it locks the roof down, and then you slide the foam in that goes alongside the hive. And he does this around all 4 of the hives on the pallet. And then he could slide insulation in between the hives to insulate them from each other. Although I would think you'd want them touching, but because the roofs overlap and stick out, they don't. But at least you prevent airflow from going in between them. So if you search for locking beehive lid on YouTube, you'll find this video by Cody Collier. It's only got 87 views. It's been out there for a couple years, but an interesting component in a hive design where you set the hive down and lock it in through that lip. All these little ideas are like morsels. When you go to design a hive, which is what I aspire to do someday, I keep all these things in mind, and maybe this engineering component can be something that can be leveraged in some sort of way. So pretty fascinating idea. The other idea with the locking hive, well, for me, I don't want to fuss with this type of equipment. I'm just going to put a brick on top, but that is what it is. I have a link to both of these in the show notes. Roundtable number 4. I wanted to follow up on the recipe from last week. I actually made it, as I try to do every time I give a recipe. I went to ShopRite yesterday, bought almond flour. That was the one component I didn't have, and I bought figs. And I looked at the recipe, and like I said in the last episode, it was very similar to like a Nutri-Grain texture, which I'd never had before. I'm telling you, they came out really good. As I record this episode, I recorded part of it this morning, and I'm now sitting here, and it's 1:45 in the afternoon. Just finished making lunch and making these things. And like the recipe said, you mix a couple of ingredients in the food processor, you put it in the fridge. That becomes the dough, and then you put the fig layer in the middle, and I don't like straight figs, so I put dried apricot and dried a little bit of lemon juice to make it tart, and just a touch of honey with it, and I'm telling you, it came out really, really good. I see him upstairs. I just pulled him out of the oven and put him on the rack, and I made a little test piece to try and split that with Brian and I and just ate it. Wow. That recipe was really good. So thank you to the Honey Lady, H-O-N-E-E, for sharing that recipe because, you know, it was a little fussy to make, but I've always wanted to make something like that, and I think that's pretty cool. Be a neat thing to make if you're going to a party or whatever, a special thing, and, you know, that's when you make stuff like that for me. It's too fussy to make on an everyday thing, but every once in a while when you want to make something different, that's a cool thing to make. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, go back to episode 109 and look for the Honey, H-O-N-E-E feature at the end. I gave a recipe for these snack bars that I made. A Kevin moment on that. You know, when you make these things, you put them on parchment paper. I never understood how parchment paper would survive in the oven. Stuff's pretty ingenious, and I never knew what it was until a little while ago. I made a recipe with the stuff, and now I use it all the time, and I really like it. Yeah, parchment paper, it's cool. End of Kevin moment. Roundtable number 5, homemade honey straws. You know, I never contemplated making these at home. We sell honey straws at our beekeeping fairs for people who don't want to buy honey, and also as a draw to the kids who tend to like it, and they're, you know, pretty inexpensive. If you've never seen one, it's a straw that is crimped on both ends, and typically what happens is they use heat to melt the end, and it creates a flat surface, which when you take your teeth and you bite on the two ends, it pops it open, and then you can suck the honey out of it. So in this case, a blog article explains how to make one at home, and it involves using a bear. Make sure you get a plastic one with a lid that has the hole the right size of a dimension that you could put a straw over it. You take your bear and you squeeze it till the honey enters the straw, and then you clamp it off. And using a pair of needle nose pliers, you hold it to a small candle, fuse the end. Then you stand it up on end so that all the honey runs down to the fuse end. And you take the needle nose pliers and you heat the other end to seal it. And it seals the honey together for you to take on the go. In the picture that they show, I'm not clear why it makes sense, because it looks like they're actually holding the end of the plastic to the candle and burning it, and it's all black. And maybe what I'm seeing is that they keep the needle nose pliers, which are metal, next to the flame and let the heat from the pliers stay on the plastic until it fuses it. And they're not literally burning the plastic, but hopefully you don't get a blackened plastic end. So to run through it, you take the straw, you stick it over the little nozzle of the honey bear, you squeeze the honey in, you fuse the one end, stand it on end so all the honey runs down to the fused end, you fuse the other end, and then you wipe the straw down, make sure it's clean, doesn't have any residue, and you slip them into your backpack, and then I'm hoping you don't have to use a pair of scissors to get them open, but maybe you bring a pair of scissors depending on the type of straw that you have. So it'd be a neat little trick to make a couple of these. Pretty inexpensive. You could probably knock them out pretty quickly. If you're having a party, you want to give them to your kids or take them along for a little pick-me-up on a hike or something. I'll have a link to the show notes of the blog post that I referred to. Roundtable number 6, I want to talk about oxalic acid approval. Got a message from Charles Klein about a couple things, and one of them said oxalic acid. The EPA approved it for use in the United States over a year ago. You know, I kind of knew that, but I'm still not sure whether or not there was something special that had to happen in New Jersey. I'm looking at the document on my browser that says EPA okays oxalic acid for varroa mite control. And it talks about the fact that it's such a need in order to combat varroa mites that they used the studies from Canada to expedite and allow it to be used in the United States. I've heard the state apiarist and others talk about approval of certain things in certain states by some Section 18 approval. I don't know if that's what this is or that's something different. Perhaps I'm behind the times, right? So I wanted to make sure that, Charles, thanks for sharing that with me, that perhaps I'm wrong in the context that you should be allowed to use it. To that end, I was peeking around on Randy Oliver's website about his latest research on this. And in the EPA document, it explains that there's three ways to use the product. And I was wondering whether or not they recommended a certain way. First one is by solution to package bees. It says oxalic acid and sugar solution is applied as a spray to the package. The second one is, and what I'm talking about, and I should have been clear about this, application methods and labeling. This is what the EPA says is allowable. The first one is by solution to package bees, what I just described. The second one is by solution to beehives. Oxalic acid in sugar solution is trickled between frames and other spaces. And looking in the research that Randy Oliver does, one of the key things he says about this method, if you're planning to do this, is that you have to heat the oxalic acid in water to melt it and then add it to the sugar solution. And go look at his formulations, but I think it was like a half teaspoon is dribbled between each of the frames and it has to be directly applied to the bees. The third method is vapor treatment of beehives. Oxalic acid dihydrate is heated and the vapor sublimates into the hive. And in a recent episode, I talked about Randy's work there and the discussion that, you should really wear a respirator there. Nothing to mess around with. And Randy agrees in his statements. Now, of course, there's a fourth method, and perhaps the EPA a year ago knew nothing about that, but they're talking about impregnating it in certain substrates. And again, we've talked about this. They're using shop towels as the latest thing. They used cardboard strips at one point. In using oxalic acid, like some of the other treatments, it only applies to the bees in the hive that are not capped. In other words, a lot of the varroa mite problems for a hive live in the hive because they're in behind the capping. And to my knowledge, only formic acid and mitoway quick strips is effective against that, as it will penetrate into the comb. So as with all treatments, if you're opting this route, one of the key things, and in the statement here from the EPA, that needs to be reiterated. It says any varroa mite population has the potential to become resistant to acaricides. Resistance development is affected by both frequency of application and rate dose of application. Continued reliance on a single class of miticide or single miticide with the same mode of action will select for resistant individuals, which may dominate the mite population in subsequent generations. In order to prevent resistance development and to maintain the usefulness of individual acaricides, it's important to adopt appropriate resistance management strategies. And what they're saying is, when possible, rotate the use of miticides to reduce selection pressure as compared to repeatedly using the same product, mode of action, or chemical class. If multiple applications are required, use different mode of action each time before returning to a previously used one. Talked about this a number of times. If you keep trying to kill the mites and you use a certain treatment all the time, certain mites might be resistant and those mites will grow and become the dominant mite. So you use a different treatment option that kills those mites and you get them all and you can continue to have effective treatments. As with any of the recommendations on this, the typical pattern is make sure that you're monitoring. Don't treat if you don't have to. Know your thresholds. So I'll still have a conversation with Tim when I see him and just ask him if there's anything I need to know to convey this information correctly. But I'll provide a link to the document. There's a lot more information in this EPA statement. The one that I'm looking at is posted on DEDANT's website. So you could take a look at that. It's DEDANT.com/EPA OKS oxalic acid for varroa mite control. And each one of those words after .com has a dash in between it. So thanks to Charles for sending that in. Got another email about oxalic acid. This one came from Julius Davin. It was a study that was published. The original article name is Evaluation of Oxalic Acid Treatments Against a Mite Varroa Destructor and Secondary Effects on Honeybee Apis mellifera. It's interesting to me of what the impact of the bees is. That's a conversation that I hear frequently. In this case, it looks like, and I didn't read the article, I just scanned it, I'll process it and bring it back if I get a chance, but it looks like they were using a dribble method, and what they were looking for was whether or not different concentration had different impacts on the bees and varroa itself. One of the interesting tidbits that I found in the scan had to do with the fact that longevity of the colony to overwinter upon treatment was impacted by the concentration of oxalic that was used in the treatment itself. Even percentages up to 25% of the colony didn't survive over winter, from what I think I read. Again, I just scanned it. But it certainly piqued my interest. And this is how some of these journal articles come to pass. You start reading it and you pick up on a little nugget and you go, I'd really like to know more about that. That's an interesting aspect. And you read through it. So that one goes on the pile. And if I get a chance, I'll parse through that and see what it has to say. So thanks, Julius, for sending that along. And listen, if you have any articles or things of interest or questions that you want to know, send them in. Kevin@BKCorner is my email address. I flag everything and come back and look at it. Paul and Karen Smith wrote in from Brisbane, Australia. They were asking about the bee cage that I refer to on certain episodes. And I'll bring that topic back for our next episode. They wanted to know, what is the method in which you do education with live bees? I thought that was an interesting question. So I'll see if I could prepare something and bring it back. I, of course, mentioned that we're in the process of building a bee cage for our association and plan to do an article on that, if possible. Got the roof to build, and we'll be pretty much done with it. All the glass is in, all the walls are done, the door is in, floor is done. Just have to build the roof. We've had some conversations about how to do that, which is pretty fascinating. So got to pick up and finish that project here probably in May timeframe, and then we'll have pictures to post and some information to share about that. One of the questions Paul was keen to know is, how do you get the bees back in the box from the cage itself? So we'll make sure we answer that when we talk about it. Another listener email that came through, I guess I've switched to listener email, came from Jeremy Duggan, had to do with beetle baffles. These are those strips that you put on your board, specifically your bottom board, and they create an overhang over the edge. And when the beetle tries to crawl up, they can't navigate it to get up inside the brood chamber. Pretty ingenious idea. Pretty inexpensive way to go about it. He also talks about the microfiber cloth method that we've mentioned a couple times. And he sent along a couple pictures, so I'll look to see if I could put that on the pile and talk about it. We don't deal too much with hive beetles here in New Jersey. It gets really cold in the winter, so it kills whatever's in the ground. But I know, get down to like the Maryland area and south, and it just becomes the bane of the existence of trying to figure those out. And the beetle blaster hive trap for hive beetles, that thing seems to be the way to go, from what I understand. Most people have good success with those. So I think that wraps up the pile of everything that I had to talk about here. I'm waiting for spring. I'm waiting for those warm days. The birds have returned. The trees are in bud and have leafed. There's a lot of dogwood trees that have white flowers on them. Everything looks great, but it just doesn't feel like spring, and I'm trying to figure that out. Perhaps it'll get a couple warm 65, 70 degree days. And life will be better, and I'll get more in a springtime mood. But it just seems like lately I'm not feeling the vibe. It's a little too cold. Maybe it's good. It'll allow the plants to store up a lot of energy, and it'll allow spring to go a little bit further. Who knows? Anyway, that's all I've got for this episode. Let's go ahead and wrap it up. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.